Welcome to the Freedom Report, broadcasting from Alexandria, Virginia. Welcome to the Freedom Report. I'm your host, Austin Peterson. Who's Austin Peterson?
Liberty champion Austin Peterson, this Justin Bieber lookalike, and a powerful advocate for liberty.
Who's Austin Peterson? I'm an American. I love life, liberty, and family, but I'm not a conservative. I'm a hardcore libertarian. What am I doing here? I'm trying to restore the republic. The Libertarian Republic is a website aimed at furthering the ideas of economic freedom and personal liberty. I don't really care about parties. All I care about are ideas. And the one idea I care the most about? Freedom! That's right, pure freedom on the Freedom Report podcast.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back to the Freedom Report podcast. I'm your host, Austin Peterson. Today is Tuesday, June the 17th. Here with my co-host, Ian Hewitt. Ian, welcome back to the show.
Good to be here.
Ian, I think it's time for us to make a very sad announcement, just because I don't want to surprise people on Friday with the sad news. That why don't you go ahead and tell everybody what's going on?
Well, I will be in the near future returning to Kansas, and I will be working on studying for the LSAT.
So what does that mean? Ian, to just tell everybody the truth, the sad truth.
I will be leaving the Libertarian Republic in the near future.
No, gosh, ladies and gentlemen, like for the enormous amounts of people that have been listening to this show, you've probably been listening to us probably since Ian got here. That's really when we got this huge audience, and it's thanks to Ian that we actually have such a huge audience. So I just want to say thank you very much. If you're a regular listener to the Libertarian Republic, do me a favor. Unless you're driving, don't take your hands off the wheel, but definitely... Let's give Ian a round of applause. Ian, well done. Fantastic job as associate editor of the Libertarian Republic. So what does that mean? What does that mean for the podcasters out there? That means that you're going to have to put up with Austin Peterson solo for a little bit of time. And I'll be also working very hard.
You'll continue to have guests.
I'll be continuing to have guests. This means it's going to put a fire under my butt, so I'll have to get more good quality guests to replace this fantastic, brilliant young gentleman, Ian Hewitt.
Who it's been a fantastic 6 months, and Austin and I don't always agree, but he's always been an excellent mentor and has definitely influenced my worldview for the better.
I'm glad to hear that. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to be talking today about something that Ian and I thought was just absolutely hilarious. And Ian and I are, you know, probably not going to agree on some of these things, and some of these things are probably going to offend you, and maybe some of the language is going to offend you, but again, these are not my words. These are the words of Mr. Gavin McInnes, who's one of my new favorite writers.
And the goal of this article, I think, is besides to raise some valid points, to be as offensive as possible.
Well, that's what Gavin McInnes does. If you're not familiar with Gavin McInnes, he
is a shock jock.
Right, co-founder of Vice magazine. He's now not with them anymore, presumably because he was too libertarian or conservative for their taste.
Well, I mean, it's not hard to see how he left if you read articles like this. He's right. Like, how can I offend as many people as possible?
Okay, so we're going to talk about an article that he wrote that's a big deal in Talkies magazine right now, TalkieMag.com, and he wrote called How 15 Myths That Millennials Accept as Facts. I'll read the intro here for you, and then we'll break down each one. Last week, an everyday group of anti-gun nuts called Everytown published data that claimed there have been 74 school shootings since Sandy Hook. Most of us went, no there haven't, because we've only read about a few. The president apparently does not have access to Google because he ran straight to the papers and bleated, there is no developed country on earth that would put up with this, and it happens now once a week. We should be ashamed. He's accidentally right. We should be ashamed of these shootings. Gang violence among black youths is totally out of control, and the lack of fathers has to be a factor. That's obviously not the narrative he was going for, however. He was more likely going for the same old evil white American patriarchy garbage we were all taught in school. So let's take a step back and explain to children and the president of the United States that most of the truths they take for granted are completely false. For example, let's start with number one. He says, number one myth is this country was stolen from the Indians. We fought them for 400 years. They fought against us, alongside us, and behind us. Before we got here, they were fighting each other. And yes, it was savage. War before civilization, the myth of the peaceful savage, describes horrific mass graves from way before we got here. Indians used to shoot arrows into their victims for hours after the guy died so he'd be fucked in the afterlife. I'll say it, spare you that word. The smallpox blankets were likely a myth. The worst we know, the worst we behaved was probably Wounded Knee, but the reason everyone knows about it is because it was meticulously documented by outraged whites who were and still are disgusted by our behavior there. Is he right on that one, Ian?
I think this was one of his more interesting points, because I agree that the narrative of European settlers versus American Indians is often oversimplified.
Right.
Really, it wasn't that simple. There were a lot of American Indian factions that were allied with various colonizing factions at one time or another. They were fighting each other a lot of the time. He had a line in there where he said, you know, they fought also beside us and they fought against each other.
Right.
So it's not a sort of unilateral good versus evil dichotomy like we often see in our history books. I think you can recognize injustices were committed without falling into that oversimplistic narrative.
Well, a really interesting article that I read was the idea that American Indians actually were decimated by a plague before the European settlers came en masse. So when Christopher Columbus was sailing up the East Coast, sort of documenting the New World and mapping it out, They had reports that the East Coast, the coastline, was thick with smoke from fires of the American Indians. And then when they returned, they had been decimated. And so some forensic scientists have done some research on this, and it showed that the American Indians, their population was reduced by like 3/4 before the European settlers arrived. I'm not saying that the land was totally uninhabited, but the sort of narrative that we get from progressives is that we came here and just immediately started pushing all the American Indians aside. Well, no, there was quite a bit of land that was available for the colonists to come and to make hold of. I mean, you know, that's homesteading, you know, like that's a libertarian principle. If it's not, the land isn't being used, and certainly some of the land was appropriated. I'm not going to say that's not true, but there was quite a bit of land that was available to be homesteaded, would you say?
His point about outrage was fair, and that reminds me a lot of when people are sort of arguing that Christendom has been an immoral historical force, they will often point to the Spanish colonization of the Americas and the injustices that the Spaniards committed ostensibly in the name of God and glory. But in fact, when you look at the record, there were a lot of Dominicans primarily and other Christian leaders who were in staunch opposition to the abuses being perpetrated against native-born people living in the Americas. And in fact, at one point, Bartolome de las Casas actually persuaded the emperor to put the conquest on hold while abuses could be investigated. So you can recognize that atrocities were committed, like the one he pointed to, while also seeing a lot of the people living at the time recognize that these things were immoral and spoke out against them. So it's not really fair to hold these injustices against the whole collective, so to speak.
Okay, so you know what? I was wrong with my statistic. I said 3/4. Listen to this. It wasn't 3/4 of the Indians that died in a plague before we got here. It was 96% of all of the Indians in Massachusetts were wiped out. Listen to this.
Oh, in Massachusetts?
Yeah, listen to this. There's a pretty important detail our movies and textbooks left out of the handoff from Native Americans to white European settlers. It begins in the immediate aftermath of a full-blown apocalypse. In the decades between Columbus's discovery of America and the Mayflower landing at Plymouth Rock, the most devastating plague in human history raced up the east coast of America. Just 2 years before the Pilgrims started the tape recorder on New England's written history, the plague wiped out about 96% of the Indians in Massachusetts. In the years before the plague turned America into the Stand, a sailor named Giovanna de Verrazano sailed, probably named for the Verrazano Bridge in New York, sailed up the East Coast and described it as a, quote, densely populated and so smoky with Indian bonfires that you could smell them burning hundreds of miles out at sea. Using your history books to understand what America was like in the 100 years after Columbus landed there is like trying to understand what modern-day Manhattan is like based on the post-apocalyptic scenes from I Am Legend. Very interesting. Historians estimate that before the plague, America's population was anywhere between 20 and 100 million. Europe's population at the time was 70 million. So the plague would eventually sweep west, killing at least 90% of the native population. For comparison's sake, the Black Plague killed off between 30 and 60% of Europe's population. Very interesting, and it's something that Gavin McInnes doesn't note in his point here. But we got to move on. We got 15 points to get through.
Are there 15?
15, yeah. Number two.
Millennials do believe a lot of ridiculous things.
They do. Number two, we are a nation of immigrants. He says, no, we're not. We're a nation of citizens. The country was built on legal immigration, and the ones who made it through learned the language and assimilated. Many didn't get in. Today's scenario is 15 million illegals ridiculing those of us who played by the rules. My green card took 15 years to get, and I brought a ton of jobs with me, he says. This is Gavin McInnes talking. The Statue of Liberty doesn't say, give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free, and all their relatives. Oh, and don't give me that old they're doing jobs Americans won't do line. They're doing jobs Americans won't do for that price. In Canada, there are no Mexicans, and the landscaping still gets done. We use teenagers. Now, I think
Gavin... I have a few points of disagreement.
We got some disagreements with Gavin here.
It does say masses.
Yeah.
And also, yes, they are doing jobs Americans won't do. Part of a job is the wage you are paid for the job. If you're not doing the job for a certain price, you're not doing the job.
Right. Well, and also, he makes the mistake by saying, by trying to compare illegal immigration today with illegal immigration back then.
Oh, right, the immigrant-citizen dichotomy. Like, of course we are a nation of immigrants. He's simply defining immigrant as someone who doesn't assimilate and become a citizen.
Right. Well, and remember, you know, he's complaining about our immigration system today, but our immigration system today isn't like it was when we were at the height of one of the greatest eras in American history. It is the progressive era, but it was the era of Ellis Island when my immigrants, the Pedersens, came over here. Pedersens came over and they became Petersens, Petersens. We've been at war with the Petersons, Sons, ever since. But, you'd have to understand that it was very easy. When you came over to Ellis Island back then, you came with your family, you answered some questions, and then you got in. Now you have to wait 15 years. Well, that's the problem, and that's the government's problem. And I think Gavin McInnes is wrong to conflate those two eras.
Well, put simply, if you're concerned about a strain on the welfare state, then the problem is the welfare state, and you should campaign to reduce that and to promote community autonomy and strong families and so forth. We don't, as libertarians, say, oh, well, we have to keep drugs illegal because welfare might finance it otherwise. We campaign both against the welfare state and against drug prohibition.
Well, and remember that when they say, oh, they come here and they get welfare, remember, when they come here legally, they qualify for welfare. If you want people to not come and get welfare benefits, you should want them to come here illegally, because coming here illegally disqualifies you from benefits. Coming here legally is the problem if it's a welfare issue. So,
well,
that's
more importantly, as I saw you point out on Facebook recently, the border is not going to be closed. It's not going to happen.
Oh, you're talking about my post that I made today, aren't you?
Right.
I made a post today that said that the border will never be sealed because Republicans want the labor and Democrats want the votes. And I want tacos and poutine.
So, again, insofar as there are problems that result from large-scale immigration, you actually will enable their redress by decentralizing power. If there's a problem like welfare abuse, that can be most effectively addressed at the community level.
Absolutely.
So don't advocate for more federal power on this one issue. It makes your worldview incoherent.
Okay, we got to move on because we're going long. Number three, this country was built on slavery. Yeesh, this old trope, Gavin says. Some rich Southerners had slaves. Then there was a civil war and America's bank account dropped to zero. After that, the country was rebuilt from scratch without slavery. As Pat Buchanan puts it, we didn't start slavery, we ended it. And don't get me started on reparations, we've already paid them. Now, Gavin McInnes is talking about the fact that after the Civil War, our country was basically destroyed, so it was like a reset button. And he points out Pat Buchanan, which is probably not the best example to use for these arguments, just because he's widely seen as like a racist, you know, immigrant hater kind of a guy. What are you smiling?
He's seen as xenophobic, I suppose.
He's seen as xenophobic, right, exactly. So, but Gavin McInnes doesn't care.
As an arch conservative, and he's certainly staunchly opposed to immigration. Yeah, but I think it's an important point that people too often don't recognize that slavery was a global historic evil and not a uniquely American one.
That's true. It's just, I think we get crap because we were the last civilized nation to get rid of it. All right, so America is racist, Gavin McInnes. This is a trope, something that people believe. He says, I highly recommend you cut out this monitoring hate speech crap. I'm warning you, you're going to end up censoring the people you're trying to protect. Studies show that white people are actually the least racist group. Getting rid of all the racists would mean America would be almost all white. Therefore, fighting racism is racist. Whoa.
And what he's talking about there is a comparison of country to country. Mm-hmm. People did a survey about racist attitudes that people held.
Guess
and
which
the,
country
the
is
most
the most
racist?
The most racist
country, I believe, was India.
India?
Right.
Why?
The U.S. was one of the least racist on this survey. Well, I'd imagine that the high Indian results have something to do with India's caste system.
Yeah, probably. And it's
or their border and with Pakistan, well, which has had a lot of conflict.
Yeah, and you know what's interesting? You know, like the Middle East is some of the most racist. They have some of the most racist countries right there. I can't see Israel on the map because it's so tiny, but I can see the countries around Israel, and man, them are some racist mother effers, you know? They've got, and especially in Malaysia, the Philippines, you know, America, the United States, is one of the least racist nations. Canada, too. Finland, ironically, where all the white people live, it is where all the least amount of racism is. Doesn't surprise me.
This is often posited as a uniquely American or uniquely Western problem throughout history when, as we can see here, that continues to not be the case.
And look, another one, South Africa, one of the least racist nations. Interesting. I find that very, very interesting. Russia, too, looks like one of the, it's like on the mid-range of racism. But the white countries are some of the least racist. People are more tolerant. Wow, but racism is big deal in India. So, wow.
I think it would also be important to point out here that we're not looking at one ethnic group in each of these countries.
The survey surveyed
people in general in the U.S. and
right.
Not just white Americans.
Good to know. Black youth are targeted by white men. So Zimmerman was a statistical anomaly, but that didn't stop everyone and their dog from wearing a hooded sweatshirt and tweeting all about it. Black youth are in danger, but it's not Jews from Peru who are killing them. That's pretty offensive.
I think that people posited the Zimmerman case as if it were something that happened sort of every week.
Right. Well, yeah, the idea is that, you know, like, oh, you better watch out for the white boy. He's going to come get you in your black neighborhood. It's going to be like lynchings all over again. You know what I mean? And that was just ridiculous. You know, white people aren't stalking down black people in their neighborhoods. Pretty sure. That's pretty racist of me to say, right? Number six, women make less than men. Obama tweeted this old wives' tale recently. Does anyone in the White House have a freaking computer? You know, he didn't say freaking. Women choose to make less than men because they'd rather be at their daughter's piano recital than stay at the office all night working on a proposal. Ooh, Gavin, that's so nasty. When they don't have kids, they actually make more than men. Whoa. If women were cheaper labor, we'd hire them as often as we hire illegal aliens. What? He's right.
Definitely one of his stronger points. Yeah, just because you have unequal results doesn't mean there's unequal opportunity. If you start from an assumption that you should see equal results from every individual, you come to that conclusion. But in fact, when you actually try to control for factors and see what different decisions are men and women making, then you see there isn't any evidence of widespread systemic discrimination in pay against women.
He cites a really interesting anecdote here where he talks about on the Independence recently, Jill Philpovic told me that resumes with female names do worse than the same ones with male names. He says, I'm willing to accept that, but it's not prejudice, it's postjudice. Employers have noticed their male employees are more likely to stay at the office all night working, even when their daughter does have a piano recital. Very interesting. Number seven, pro-lifers are sexist. Gavin McInnes says that most women are pro-life. To ignore their rights while touting abortion is sexist. Also, gender-based abortion is becoming more popular. He's right. We've seen how that goes for women in China. It ain't pretty. So stop using abortion rights as some kind of proof there's a war on women when the opposite is true. What do you think of that?
Well, certainly people who are in the establishment feminist camp will posit any women who disagree with them on whatever issue as sort of collaborators with the patriarchy. I imagine that would be their response to that point.
Here's an interesting one. He says, number eight, this is where I may, you know, have some disagreements with it. He says, trannies are women. He says this is a myth. He says, whether you cut your penis off or are just start saying, I'm a woman, that doesn't mean you're a woman. That trivializes what it is to be a woman. These mythical creatures can create life. You can't just throw on a wig and yell, me too. That's sexist. Ooh, you're cringing, Ian.
You're not going to have a productive debate about the importance of the categories of male and female by calling people slurs.
That's true. I agree. I don't like his language here. And I think I disagree. I mean, I'm not going to go so far as to say that gender is a construct. But, I mean, certainly people have the right to choose what they want to be. And it's not like, you know, I mean, male and female are understood as biological, you know, separation. The sexes are biologically what they are. But if you have a sex change operation, you know, you basically, you, you become that in a way. And really, what does it matter if you want to call yourself that, you know? And it's like the case of Bradley Manning and Chelsea Manning, you know what I mean? Like, why do we feel like we need to force a separation between the sexes so much? I mean, it's sort of like, you know, Gavin McInnes sounds a bit like a Rick Santorum-ish social conservative on this, where it's like,
well, I make some effort to respect other people's preferences, even if I don't always agree with them.
Right.
For instance, if Gavin McInnes knew someone who converted to Islam and they changed their name to an Islamic one, McInnes would presumably use their Islamic name even though he disagrees with Islam, as would I. I think that you can do that and respect people's personal preferences while also pointing out, hey, some of the people who are taking the gender as a social construct narrative really do believe there is no meaningful biological distinction between male and female, and or that distinction has no important social implications. And that position, I think, should be criticized. But the way that McInnes is criticizing it is not productive.
I agree. I don't like this on the Gavin. Sorry, dude. Number 9, and this is just, I don't know how this is a myth. I think Gavin's just pulling this out of his butt. He says, gays lead the same lives we do. Is that really like a myth?
This was the most nonsensical point. I don't know what he was trying to accomplish with this.
He says, I've heard Jon Stewart say this, and it often comes up when discussing gay marriage and adoption. Do any of these people know any fags? They are perfectly wonderful human beings with whom I spend much of my time, but they are also hair-whiteningly decadent. They call me an amateur for having participated in a couple threesomes. They've had dozens of eightsomes. So he says, gays lead the same lives we do, but he sort of criticizes the hypersexuality of the homosexual community, which is really not...
I don't know
he's
if
not
he's
debunking any
criticizing
myth
it necessarily, but I don't know if it's possible to have any serious discussion about this point.
There isn't really any serious discussion, because he's talking about gay marriage and adoption, and just what exactly about having a decadent lifestyle would disqualify you from adopting a child or being, you know, being a good parent. You know, lots of great parents have awesome sex, you know, and there's really nothing wrong with that. I think he sounds a little bit like a social conservative butthead on this one.
Well, McInnes has talked elsewhere about his own more decadent lifestyle.
Yeah.
So I don't
Dude's
know.
Dude's covered in tattoos. He looks like a slob, and he's got, you know.
I think his point here is that the perception is incorrect. I don't think he's necessarily offering a prescription, but it's not a productive point.
Well, yeah, and here's the thing. Yeah, Gavin McInnes is like the example of a decadent lifestyle for straight people. I mean, we watched the preview for his movie where he's getting a blowjob in a bathroom doing cocaine and all kinds of stuff, and he's using all kinds of filthy language. So I think he's not the best example to be, like, criticizing homosexuals in this case, and using that as an example, decadence.
Right, if you're admonishing people to live a more disciplined lifestyle, then being as crass and obnoxious as possible is not the way to do that.
Absolutely. Number 10, Christians are anti-science. Maybe 1 in 10 Americans believes that the Earth is only a few thousand years old, and most of those people are old ladies and dirt-poor farmers. They're not shutting down schools and canceling Cosmos. The other 90% of us are totally okay with the Big Bang Theory. Even the Pope supports it. We understand there's evolution and an incredible universe. We just think God is the one who set the whole thing up. Also, if you love science so much, stop refusing vaccinations for your kid. You're literally making us sick. Okay, he makes some good points in
this
here.
This is one of my favorite points.
Yeah.
In fact, so a lot of people will say that there are more young Earth creationists in the United States and in Christendom in general than there actually are. When you ask people very specific questions, it does look like, as McInnes indicated, a very small number of Christians really hold to the tenets of young Earth creationism. So it's not as representative of Christianity as a whole as people would like. I'm also glad he nodded towards the contributions that Christians have historically made to the sciences. Newton and Descartes were extremely Christian, etc. He pointed out the inventor of the Big Bang Theory, Mendel, of course, a pioneer of genetics.
Right.
And that's often overlooked by people who are zealots for media like Cosmos.
Right, and you have to remember, I think probably one of the important...
Who like to posit Christians as this repressive force that silenced science, when in fact Christians were at the forefront of scientific advancement throughout much of our history.
Well, his defense of Christians, I think, is actually not the most important part here, because I think the most important part is the dig that
he
took at liberals.
Well, of course we're going to disagree on that, right?
Well, no, because, I mean, obviously, like, it's most Christians aren't anti-science. You know, I think you and I agree with that. I'm not a Christian, but I think that most Christians nowadays tend to be a little bit more, I don't like to use progressive, but are pro-science. They just, It's just the bad apples that spoil the bunch.
Again, well, and I think that the pro-science attitude has been traditionally true of Christianity. But you're right. The criticizing liberals for being selective about what science they affirm is also
important. Thank you. And here's the important part, because there are so many conspiracy theorist liberals out there who are against vaccinations, and they're also crazy on things like GMO foods and like, you know, no offense, but raw milk and things like that, which I think is just nuts. You know, like so the reality is that liberals, like you said, they're selective on their biases for this, because they're a crap load of conspiracy theorist leftists. Steve Horowitz refers to them as conspiracy theory socialists. And these are people who believe, you know, in like a lot of the grand conspiracies and the Illuminati stuff, even on the crazier end of the spectrum here. But he used the example of vaccinations, and, you know, people like Jenny McCarthy are actually causing real damage. And there's no evidence right now that global warming is necessarily causing damage, which we'll get to in number 12 in this, but we still got to get to number 11. But the claim that Christians are anti-science, you can make the exact same claim for progressive liberals when it comes to vaccinations and GMO foods. But let's move on. Number 11, we need free healthcare. Not so fast. Have you seen the way this administration handles money? We're $17 trillion in the hole. That's a lot. Thanks, Kevin. 17 trillion seconds ago, we were cavemen trying to figure out fire. This country is rife with severe obesity and millions upon millions of illegals. We don't have the cohesion other free healthcare countries have, so this perfectly reasonable idea may be impossible. He's using the argument that because our nation is so large and diverse that socialism wouldn't work here. Maybe it works in smaller ways, that it won't work in a huge country with a huge national debt. What do you think about
that? Well, I don't
argument?
Think it's perfectly reasonable to suggest that, right, as he pointed out, you can set up some sort of centralized planned economy over hundreds of millions of people.
Mm-hmm.
When people say socialism works on a small scale, if they're talking about community collaboration, I think that that's a natural and healthy human development and doesn't require any sort of coercion the way socialism does as we traditionally think of it. I'm not sure it's helpful to understand communities working together as socialism. Okay. The sort of central state he's criticizing is socialist, and of course that's not going to work.
Right, right. Let's move on. Number 12, the Earth is dying. Gavin says there's a lot of evidence that says the Earth is warming, but not a ton of conclusive evidence that it's our fault or that the warming is a bad thing. We keep hearing about a consensus, but it's ecologists, not real scientists. What the experts and politicians really agree on is that we need more funding to pay them to look into this terrible problem. Bingo! He's right on this one.
I would also point out that, more importantly, if it is our fault and it is a bad thing, that does not automatically mean that the solution is international law to lower emissions.
Right, right. So moving on. Next is 13. Things are getting worse. The air has never been cleaner, we've never lived longer, crime's an all-time low. By virtually every possible metric, life has never been better. Yes, there was a school shooting recently. That doesn't change the hate fact that schools have never been safer. Traveling, eating, fornicating, fighting, all safer than ever. The list goes on and on. I saw a homeless man today checking his iPhone while he asked for change. Does anyone in this country not have a TV? If you think things were so much better back then, get in a time machine and go there. Make sure you get your shots first, though. God help you if you get sick.
Well, I'm sure McInnes would agree there are negative trends in American politics. Mm-hmm. And I would also point out, very importantly, that since people have started taking happiness surveys in the United States, self-reported happiness has continued to decline. People are worse and worse off in that respect. If you look at Putnam's data in Bowling Alone, a very important essay, people have been, for several decades now, less and less involved in their communities, in mutual aid societies. They know their neighbors less and less. So I think that we are technologically better off, but that isn't necessarily going to produce better social results. We need to address that issue separately.
Now that we got two more points to go. One I think is kind of BS, and the other one I think he's totally right on. This is the one I think is totally BS. He says, number 14, diversity is our strength. When it comes to restaurants, this is true, and that is why people always use restaurants to prove it. By any other standard, it tends to go pretty badly. I'm a race mixer, but our family has decided to err towards Western values more than the American Indian ones because the West is the best. What the hell kind of point is that? Assimilation leads to a sense of fraternity, and that means a cohesive society, not backed up by any source here. You ever see a wave pool in Japan? They're packed in there like sardines, but they don't mind because they're all the same. Really?
He's again stressing cultural assimilation here.
He says, when integration is discouraged, you get Balkanization, and we saw what happened in the Balkans. They played soccer with human heads. Gavin, come on, this is BS.
I would point out that the reason he was able to compare different cultures and choose Western culture was precisely because that choice was put before him.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not a cultural relativist. I think there is one best thing for everyone to do, but we're able to see the best thing by comparing possibilities. So I think that diversity functions like polyculture. Mm-hmm. By having different solutions, we can most effectively address certain problems.
Absolutely.
Now, what he might be getting at is that if you have groups with irreconcilable interests stuck under one unitary authority, as we're seeing in Iraq now, then that can cause violent conflict. But the problem there is not diversity. The problem there is authoritarianism, and the solution is libertarianism, decentralizing power, not eliminating diversity.
Right.
Let people manage their own internal affairs. The problem is not that people are diverse. It's right. That they're not free enough.
Well, actually, I think people are better off if they're diverse, because if you look at human biology and genetics, then the one thing that I've studied is the impact of diversity on the genes and how spreading genes apart, spreading the gene pool farther apart, the healthier the children tend to be. Now, this is just an anecdote. A lot of people like to say, oh, wow, look how beautiful the children of this mixed race couple is. I wonder if that isn't an example of superior genes because you spread it farther apart. Remember, what happens when you're too inbred is you get retarded children. So if you don't want a culture of genetic diversity, you're going to get inbred. That works the same way with your ideas. You say you like to have a diversity of ideas. Well, I think diversity in human ecology is good.
You're right. That's why I used the metaphor of polyculture. Now, there's right. No such thing as superior genes, it's important to point out. You're mm-hmm. talking about a subjective preference for people you consider more attractive.
Well, sure.
We should always remember that evolution is not linear. It's just that people can be, and other organisms can be more or less adapted to certain circumstances.
Well, there may be superior genes. Here's the thing, because, you know, obviously, if you, race is really, from a genetic level, race is sort of insignificant, because we all have 99.9% of the same genes. It's really, like, the difference between humans are just, is almost, you know, totally ridiculous to look at on a genetic level, except for a few small differences. And those differences are somewhat varied on race, because African Americans, for example, they have a tendency towards sickle cell anemia, for example. So, and there's a race of Jews, I believe the Ashkenazi Jews, they will have blood tests before, because if they're too inbred, then they have, their children have a tendency to have more.
This goes back directly to my polyculture metaphor,
okay.
Right? Different groups of people genetically are more or less open to certain diseases. So, right, the fact that we have a genetically diverse world mm-hmm. means that humanity is protected from attacks by diseases. If we all had those same sorts of predispositions to different diseases or protections against different diseases, then we would be much more susceptible to being wiped out and being dealt long-term damage. But
right.
In fact, in the same way that ideas, when we have multiple ideas, we can most effectively come up with the best solution, genetic diversity helps us safeguard ourselves against environmental challenges.
And if you want to learn more about this, there's a great documentary that you can go out there and watch for free online. It's a PBS documentary. It's the Evolution series. And the documentary is called Why Sex? So why do human beings have sex? And basically, evolutionary biologists believe that the reason why humans have sex, rather than producing asexually, where we don't have
to
have
sex, produce more diversity,
is
so
to produce
we're
more
same.
Diversity. So we're
precisely.
Not all the same, because having more diversity gives us an added layer of protection against diseases. Okay, so last one. Then we got to move on. We're going long here. Number 15. We're all equal. He says, you know there's retards, right? He says, you realize the children of geniuses tend to be smarter than the children of stupid people, yeah? This is why they ask sperm donors questions. That's what happens when idealists have to practice what they preach. They scoff at eugenics until it's time to make a baby. They love the gay lifestyle until their son brings home a tranny. They love diversity.
What are you talking about there?
Me either. They love diversity until it's time to choose a place to live or a school for their children. They pretend we're all equal, but they insist the government enforce this because they secretly know it isn't true. And in fact, see themselves as superior to everyone else, probably.
This is relevant to the point we were just making, mm-hmm. that individuals are diverse.
Right, exactly. But, you know, he talks about the idea that we're all equal. And I actually made this point yesterday when I was reading an article in Salon about a liberal who left libertarianism, like the 100th article that Salon produced on a liberal who left libertarianism.
You know, by the way, we have to make this point real quick. Part of the reason mm-hmm. Salon produces so many hit pieces on libertarianism is because libertarians then post these things everywhere and contribute tons of traffic to them.
That's true.
So libertarians encourage this sort of thing by driving tons of traffic to Salon when Salon produces a piece like this. You and I know, because we run a website, when something gets a lot of traffic, we try to do more of it.
Exactly.
Because it's a profit-based website. So don't incentivize Salon.
Thank you. Yeah. And so my point of this was that hierarchies will always exist. And the idea of egalitarianism is utopian. And I think the reason that why hierarchies will always exist is because, you know, quote from Milton Friedman, people who are free are not equal. People who are equal are not free. And the idea is that in order for us to sort of become equal, government would have to force us into uniformity. We would have to have a...
It would be like Harrison Bergeron, if you've ever read that short story. Where, the more attractive people are forced to cover up, and the more intelligent people are given electrical shocks to their brain. I don't think that egalitarianism, especially the way Marx envisioned it, is utopian in a positive sense. I think it's nightmarish, for all the reasons we just talked about, to imagine a uniform world where people are identical, where people don't have different strengths, mm-hmm. where the sexes aren't different, where individuals don't have different interests. I think these things make humanity beautiful and make the world a more wonderful and more productive place to live in. So,
and this is where you need Ayn Rand.
I don't see uniformity as a positive thing to envision at all.
I agree.
In fact, this is why I say I think Marxism is worse in theory than it is in practice. Thank God Marxist governments aren't actually able to impose uniformity the way they envision.
Fantastic point there, yes. And, you know, I think that this is where people need to read Ayn Rand, because Ayn Rand was all about the greatness of the individual, embracing your greatness. One of her favorite quotes that I like to mention whenever people are like, oh, Austin Peterson, you just got such a big ego, Leif Bieberson. And I like to quote Ayn Rand here and say that ego is the fountainhead of all human progress. If I did not think that I was capable of greatness, Ian, how could I ever achieve greatness? And so the idea that, oh, we are all equal would be to submit that I am the same as everybody else in my classroom. When I knew, and when I was in fifth grade and everybody was screwing around and I'm reading books and paying attention in class, and I was in my high school senior class, my senior superlative was teacher's pet, you know, given to me by the rest of the class because, yeah, I paid attention. I was good at school. I loved school. If I thought that I wanted to be like everybody else, I wouldn't have been one of the best in my class.
And it's not just helpful to you, but in fact, it's helpful to a class to have people with different strengths and different interests. So diversity over equality, for the reasons we just talked about.
Right, diversity.
Diversity here is advantageous and equality is deadly.
Fantastic point, Ian. This was such a great podcast. I'm so sad you're going to be leaving, dude. It just is not going to be the same without you. Are you guys going to miss Ian? Come on, tell us what you think. Do us a favor, guys. If you listen to this whole long-ass podcast and you really like us, show Ian your love. Go to the Libertarian Republic and send us an email, or even do us a bigger favor. Go to iTunes, subscribe to the podcast, or a bigger favor, leave us a good review on iTunes. That would help us out so much, and that would be such a testimony. Honestly, the success of this podcast is a testimony to the legacy of Ian Hewitt's greatness. I hope you guys will send us an email today telling Ian thank you very much for being such a fantastic associate editor. Now it's going to be all about Austin Peterson again, and I'm going to have to figure out a way to make this work. Hopefully I'll be able to hold it together with some gums and toothpicks, but I think we'll be able to keep the Freedom Watch alive. Ian Hewitt's going to go become a blood-sucking lawyer. Boo! Just where the world doesn't need another lawyer. But he'll be a great one. He's a firm defender of the Constitution, limited government. That's what we're all about here at thelibertarianrepublic.com. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for listening, and have a great day.